From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne, and this is Fresh Air. On this edition of Fresh Air, Into Madness and Back Again, former pro football player Lionel Aldridge tells us about his 12-year battle to overcome schizophrenia. Also today, we meet French filmmaker Dion Curis. Her movies include Entre Nous, Peppermint Soda, and a new film, C'est la Vie. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews the long-awaited release of one of jazz's holy grails, Dean Benedetti's recordings of Charlie Parker. And David Bianculli checks out a new TV movie about the man who wrote The Wonderful Wizard of Oz. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. More than 150 former hostages held in Iraq and Kuwait arrived in the U.S. this evening. Many of them waved as they walked down the stairs from a chartered Pan Am jet. At least one person was carried off the plane. NPR's Michael Richards reports from Andrews Air Force Base outside of Washington.
Family members cheered as the first of the former hostages stepped off the Pan Am jumbo jet and onto the red carpeted stairs leading to the runway. The horizon beyond the 747's wings was just turning to dusk as this group of Americans and Canadians filed one by one, bags in hand, into the waiting buses that would take them to a welcome center, where onward tickets, overnight accommodations, fresh coffee, and most of all, a chance to be reunited with their loved ones await. I'm Michael Richards at Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland.
An Army National Guard sergeant from North Carolina has petitioned a federal court to order his return from the Persian Gulf. An attorney for Sergeant Michael Ang said the guardsman should be returned from active duty until President Bush gets congressional approval to wage war on Iraq. The attorney, Michael Ratner, argued that President Bush has violated both the War Powers Clause of the Constitution and the 1973 War Powers Resolution. A government attorney argued that the court should stay out of the dispute because the president has never ruled out the possibility that he will ask congressional approval for the use of force against Iraq. The Bush administration isn't showing any leniency in its policy towards Saddam Hussein, despite his release of hundreds of foreign hostages from Kuwait and Iraq. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
Hostages have been streaming out of Kuwait and Iraq since Saddam Hussein's announcement last week that they were free to leave. But the gesture hasn't softened the Bush administration's rhetoric. Today, at a White House ceremony, the president cited a, quote, catalog of human misery, from looting and torture to rape and executions, and said the Iraqi treatment of Kuwait was a systematic assault on the soul of a nation.
We must speak out and stand up for the Kuwaiti people, a people whose very nation is now in the grasp of a tyrant unmoved by human decency.
White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater would not discuss specifics about the release of hostages. He said the administration will remain cautious until every one of them is back on American soil. Fitzwater said there are concerns about possible revenge against those still in Kuwait and Iraq who helped hide them from the Iraqi military. I'm Elizabeth Arnold in Washington.
Prices closed slightly higher today on Wall Street, recovering from some earlier losses after the uncompromising talk from Iraq on the Persian Gulf crisis. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 7 points to close at 2,596.78. Advances led declines by a slight margin in moderate trading of 139 million shares. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. If you had seen my guest, Lionel Aldridge, out on the street 6 years ago, you would have seen a paranoid, delusional, homeless person. If you were a football fan and had looked more closely, you might have recognized the great defensive lineman who played with the Green Bay Packers during their heyday in the 60s when they won the first two Super Bowls. Aldridge retired from football in 1973 and began working as a sports broadcaster in Milwaukee and as an analyst for NBC Sports. But within a year, he had a psychotic episode. He was hospitalized and diagnosed as schizophrenic. During the next 12 years, Aldridge was in and out of hospitals. There were times when he held down a job, but he eventually ended up on the street, broke. In 1986, some friends convinced him to go back into the hospital. This time he agreed to take medication and began to get well. Aldridge now makes his living as a public speaker, offering a glimpse inside the world of mental illness. He came to Philadelphia in October to speak at a program sponsored by the Albert Einstein Medical Center and the Philadelphia Psychiatric Center. Aldridge told me that he couldn't point to anything earlier in his life that would indicate he'd become mentally ill.
My early symptoms started in 1974, and that's the first part of my life that where I could actually say that, yeah, this was something that led to what I'm, you know, currently experiencing.
What were some of those early symptoms?
Okay, then? Yeah, I initially became very suspicious of people, very paranoid, thinking people were talking about me, looking at me, and saying things about me and out to get me somehow. I had difficulty concentrating. I had trouble completing tasks on time. I couldn't keep up with the clock, you know.
Literally, a clock on the wall.
Absolutely. Yeah, I just couldn't keep up with. I had regular responsibilities, and I was just falling behind all the time and always in a panic to get things done.
What did you say to yourself was going on?
I knew there was something wrong. So I got myself into a therapy program, which, you know, at that time it was not embarrassing or anything like that to get into therapy because we had just come out of the 60s when everyone either had a therapist or a guru. And so I got into a therapy program in 74, figuring this was something that could be corrected by a competent therapist and I'd be back as good as new in no time. But what happened is soon after getting into therapy, some months after that, I had what's called a psychotic break, which is a complete break with reality. I went crazy, and I had to be hospitalized, and that was the beginning of it.
What did friends say to you, and did people notice what was going on with you, or could you keep some of this anxiety and turmoil inside of you?
Well, I kept a great deal of it inside of me, but I became very difficult to be around. I was almost impossible to work with, so I was a problem for people who had to be in my company, and especially people who worked with me. That became real strained, and I'm sure it wasn't very pleasant for them, but I became kind of a problem to be with, yeah.
Did people say to you, Lionel, that there's something going on here? What's upsetting you, or what's going on?
They didn't say those things, but they thought them, mm-hmm. you know, and they didn't say them until after I had to blow up, and then they could look back and say, yeah, that wasn't very much like him, you know?
Did you feel then rather alone in all this?
I felt completely alone once I had to admit that I had a mental illness. It suddenly took me out of the group that I was in and placed me in a place all by myself. Once you have to say that, you know, some people have a problem with the word crazy, and I don't know whether I should say that or not, but I personally don't have a problem with that, so it's comfortable for me. In fact, I think we should say that word until people do become comfortable with it. So once you say that I'm crazy, you immediately separate yourself out from the population that you've been with, and it is very much alone. You're like on the outside looking in.
Tell us about your breakdown, your psychotic break. What actually happened?
Okay. My break occurred. I was at home when the first bizarre thing happened. I was interested in making some personality changes. I had just come through a football career, and I wanted to take the guy who played football and fix him up, dress him up, and bring him to town, you know, clean him up, and, you know, get all of the aggression out of him. So I was interested in making some changes. So I was reading a lot of what we call head books.
And kind of self-improvement
books. Yeah, self-help books. And I was reading a book called Flight of the Eagle. And one of the things that it suggested was that, you know, to know something, you should ask yourself. And I followed that and asked myself, and I answered. At least something answered in me. And that was the beginning of my hearing voices. And that was very frightening. So later on that day, I was sitting down at the dinner table, and the voice said, look at your food. So I looked down at my plate, and it turned into a plate of worms. You know, so that scared me. I jumped up and ran out. So this upset the whole family and everything. They didn't know what was happening to me. I suddenly became very scary to them. And that was just a couple of things. There were some other bizarre stuff. The next day, it was during the winter, so I ran barefoot through the snow to my car and went looking for my therapist because she was the only person that I trusted, and I wanted to find her. And I went to the place where we had our meetings normally, and it was all locked up because it was a day when no one was there. So while I was out, I started imagining or thinking that my wife was a witch, and now I couldn't come home, you know, because I thought she was somehow doing some things to me. So I spent the night out, and the next day, my therapist found out what was happening with me and came and I came home, and somehow we got together, and she suggested that I go to the hospital, that this was a safe place for me, and it was a place where I could be protected and taken care of, and I believed her, so I went.
When you say that you looked down at your plate one day,
mm-hmm.
and the voice told you to look down, and this meal became a plate of worms, you mean that. I mean, you mean that what you saw was a plate of worms.
Yeah, it was a hallucination, and that was exactly what I saw. Yeah, you know, that means simply meant I would see things that nobody else would see. Like another day, I looked at a bunch of balloons. You know those long balloons that people twist into little animals and things and that are real cute for kids? I had little kids at that time, and I had a bunch of those lying on the floor. They were blown up. And while I was looking at them, they all turned into snakes. You know, it was just the way my hallucinations ran. And I had not hallucinated before, and I found that very frightening. It took me years to get comfortable with the hallucination.
Well, especially, I would think, with hallucinations of snakes and worms. I mean, things that many people are frightened of anyway.
Yeah, I've been sitting in, I spent about 2 years or so on the street. And I recall one time I was in Florida, in Jacksonville, and I was sitting in a restaurant. I just sold, my car. This was kind of the beginning of my street experience. I just sold my car, so I had some money, and I went to a restaurant. And the waitress came with my plate, and it was a plate of maggots. You know, and I could hear people in the restaurant. I was hearing voices from people in the restaurant, you know, and people that were not there also. But, it took you have to exercise some kind of control in that situation because you're completely on your own, you know. So at that point, I began to try to exercise some control over this and not be frightened by it. So in my mind, I imagined myself moving these things off of my plate so I could go ahead and eat my food. So, you know, I had many meals like that where I would eat around what I was seeing on my plate, where my food would come and it would be alive, it would be moving, you know. So the experience of being mentally ill can be very, very frightening to a person if you are not aware of what hallucinations are like.
Could your family have helped you at that point? I mean, if your family had known that plate was, for you, a plate of worms, could they have said something to you which would have calmed you down?
I don't think so. Because this is my reality at this point. You know, it's a reality that I share with no one. But to me, it is very real. There is nothing, it doesn't look like an imagining or imagination. This is real to me. So I doubt if there's anything they could have done other than maybe take me to a hospital. That would have been the best thing that anyone could have done for me.
So no one could have offered you another reality? I mean, that point it said...
Absolutely not. They could not have offered me another reality. Forget it completely. Don't even think of offering me another reality because this one is too real for me to deny.
What did you say to yourself, or how did you explain to yourself then what was going on? Did you think you were being punished for something? I mean, to be frightened by things that we just live with day to day.
At one time, I thought I was in trouble with God, which is kind of a typical thing for people who become mentally ill. They think they've somehow done something and are being punished. Well, I thought I was in trouble with God, and I was somehow being punished because the books I had been reading... See, I was raised Christian, the books I had been reading were on Eastern religions, and I thought I had somehow fallen in disfavor with God as a result of reading those books.
What did the voices tell you? And were there several voices, or was there one voice that you heard that spoke to you?
No, over the course of the years, there are many voices. And at the same, they were telling me that I was a genius, things like this. These were early things, you know. And I was, I would write down things on notepads that made absolutely no sense to anyone else, but I thought that they were somehow brilliant and should be. This was something the world had been waiting for, and I was somehow leading the population and responsible for all these people. So there's a tremendous amount of pressure connected with that, and the responsibility, yeah.
Were there moments of clarity? I mean, moments when the hallucinations died down?
I would have moments where I would just clear up completely, but then I would just snap right back into it again. I couldn't control when I was clear and when I wasn't. So it would just happen at various times, and I would make complete sense. Everything would be fine. Everyone would think I was okay. Then a thought or something would occur, and I would be right back into it again.
Was there any kind of safety net? And you talk about being on the streets for 2 years, but here you are, a successful football player, a mm-hmm. successful sportscaster, mm-hmm. someone that we think of has some kind of safety net, has some kind of security under him, and yet there you were. You found yourself on the streets.
Yeah, there was really nothing under me. I got sick in 74. I continued to work until 1981. And by 81, my wife, because of the illness, had started divorce proceedings. So when I took a leave of absence from the job in 74, and I had to get out of the house as part of the divorce proceedings. So I threw some clothing and other things into the car and started driving around the country. I was, in effect, pretty alone at that point, you know, because there was no one I could discuss this with. How do you go and say that, you know, who do you talk to about this, you know? And so I started driving around the country and eventually wind up, when all my money ran out, I wound up on the street.
If we had passed you on the street, what would we have seen?
If you had passed me on the street at that time, you probably would not have noticed that there was anything wrong with me because I wasn't exhibiting any kind of bizarre physical behavior. If you had seen me at certain times, you would have seen me walking backwards on the street. This is a little later on. You would have seen me walking flat-footed, making sure that the flat part of my foot landed flatly on the ground.
Important to you?
Oh, yes. This was like some kind of a maze or some kind of a program that I had, a problem that I had to solve in order to regain sanity. You would have seen me not stepping on any of the cracks between the sidewalks and things like that. But so that's not really terribly bizarre. I mean, someone may see me walking like that and simply think I had a physical problem.
Right.
And if they saw me walking backwards, they would probably think that was a little bizarre. But I did all of those things while I was out there.
Lionel Aldridge is my guest on Fresh Air today. He played for the Green Bay Packers and was a sports announcer until the mid-70s when he became mentally ill. He now travels the country talking to audiences about his life and the myth of mental illness. We'll talk more after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Lionel Aldridge is my guest today. You mentioned being hospitalized, and how were you able to kind of slip through the network, I guess, of community organizations? I mean, people who are charged to take care of people who have mental illness.
This was in 1974, you know, and we weren't doing a great deal at that time for the mentally ill. They've learned a tremendous amount about what to do about people like me since then. But at that time, there wasn't, you know, in fact, they called it a nervous breakdown.
Right.
They were, you know, because I was known in the community, my illness got publicized in the paper. But my doctor said to me, I remember him saying this to me very clearly. He says, by the time I finish with the paperwork, you know, when you get out of the hospital here, he said, this will look like a common cold. So anyway, he was trying to conceal it in some way to help me. So I wouldn't be bothered by that later on. So I had the attitude that I was going to completely recover from a nervous breakdown. I just figured, well, I've been working too hard, you know, and I need to slow down a bit and take it a little easy. But and thinking that it would get better, but it just got worse. It didn't get better.
How bad did it get? And I assume that living on the streets is probably just about as bad as it gets.
Especially that's as low as it can get. It can't get any lower than that. I mean, you're the absolute bottom of this country if you're living on the street. And I was out there for a couple of years. My whole effort while I was there was trying to find a way off. And what I found out while I was there is you can't get off the street by yourself. You got to have help to get off.
How did you get help then?
Well, my route back was through the hospital. I came back to Wisconsin and went to a place that I had been in business with this man and this family. And they took me to the hospital and got me checked in after some, you know, doings, and I agreed to go. And that was the best thing, again, that could have happened to me. This was my third hospitalization, actually, in 1984, 10 years after I first got sick. And it was that hospitalization in 1984 where I started to recover.
Well, what were they able to do that they weren't able to do 10 years before that time?
Well, one of the things they were able to do was get me to go. You know, I simply would not take the medication.
Well, part of your hallucination and that somehow it was going to hurt you?
No. When I was hospitalized the first time, I took medication and it worked and I got out of the hospital. But when I got out of the hospital, I wouldn't take it anymore because I was a sports announcer. And whenever I took the medication, it slowed me down so much I couldn't talk. And I had to talk. You know, so I figured I was better off of it than I was on it. And I knew I had a problem and I would just watch myself manage me and take care of me and keep me out of trouble. And in 1981, I did that. I was able to do it that way. But, I was very paranoid. It was the hardest thing I've ever done. You know, walking away from that job and losing it all was not as hard as sitting there and performing it on the air every night, being paranoid.
Yeah. And so in the third hospitalization then, in a sense, you'd come to the point where you realized that...
I, in effect, had given up and accepted treatment. I had tried everything to help myself and had been unable to. Mm-hmm. So I accepted treatment. I took the medication. I started telling people that I was going to give the medication a chance. This is other people in the hospital with me. And as it had before, the medication worked. The hallucination stopped. The voices stopped. The paranoia was beginning to subside. And I got really excited about the possibility of getting well and started looking for what I could do to help myself in addition to what the medication was doing.
Did you feel, going into the hospital on the third try, that somehow you had failed? I mean, that you had failed on your own to control what it was you were dealing with?
I had been unable to do it. That's right. I had been unable to do it on my own. Every hospitalization I've had, I saw as a failure mm-hmm. in me to solve this. My last hospitalization, my eighth one, was a little over a year ago during the summer. And when I left that one, I felt I had finally solved it. I felt I feel in my own heart that I have finally collected and accumulated enough information on this illness that I can now keep myself out of the hospital.
And the illness you have is schizophrenia, is that
paranoid
right?
Paranoid schizophrenia, yeah.
What kind of medication
take? Haldol. In 84, when I was hospitalized, I was on 35 milligrams. Since that time... I have been down as low as one. I currently take 2 milligrams. And at the end of October, which is a very busy month for me on the circuit, my doctor that I see once a month is going to lower it to 1 milligram again. So I'm taking a very low dose, and I'm able to stay symptom-free on this small amount.
Are there side effects? Are there things...
There are side effects of the medication, which makes it, you know, taking it unattractive.
Mm-hmm.
Then you have to take another medication for the side effect, and that medication also has side effects. So I was glad to get with a doctor who believed in a minimal amount of medication and was willing to work with me to get it down.
You say you've been hospitalized 8 times.
Mm-hmm.
Was the sort of precipitating event the fact that you would stop taking the medication or that the dose was so low that it really wasn't providing what it was that you needed?
Well,
I mean, once having sort of come face to face with what you're
dealing. I understand what you're asking. And my answer to that is that there is a great deal more going on with the illness than what the medication does. It once took 35 milligrams to stabilize me. I can remember hallucinating on 6 milligrams. I currently take 2 and I'm not having any symptoms at all. So in some of the hospitalizations, at least one of them, it was because I wasn't taking the medication. And others, it was because I was allowing things like negative thinking and insecure thinking to simply expand and become a real problem for me and land me back in the hospital.
How do you control your mind? And what do you do? What can you say
to
yourself?
That's exactly what you do, is control your mind. A sick mind is what the person has who has this illness. And the mind is something that you can control. But it takes a while to learn that. You know, first of all, you may go years without even knowing that it's possible. So most of us who live with the illness live as victims of our mind. We do what our mind tells us to do. We don't know that it can be done the other way around, which is to be selective in your thought process. Choose the thoughts that you want to have and those that you'd like to expand and be a part of your life. And, you know, so you take unattractive thoughts and you stop those and you start thoughts that you want, those that are good for you and those that help you. And that's what I do. In the beginning, it takes a little work to get it going, and it takes some vigilance on your part to make it happen for yourself. But after a certain amount of time, it becomes very simple. It becomes as mindless as living the other way does. Yeah. You know? So it's a very neat thing.
And so you can really, at this point, recognize a destructive thought or a thought.
Absolutely. Well, a destructive thought, an example of a destructive thought would be sitting here thinking that you were somehow being dishonest with me and becoming paranoid about what your real purpose is in this interview, and that you were somehow giving information on me to people that I was unaware of, so they would know something about me that I didn't know.
So you could entertain that.
Yes. I could. Right now, I could have that thought if I wanted to. But I know better than that. I choose better than that. I don't want that kind of difficulty in my life. So if that thought comes up, I stop it.
Would you say there's any shame in having to be, if you have to be hospitalized then in a couple of years or next summer or something, is there any shame in that for you?
There's no shame in it. What's in it is I would feel like I had failed and would have to start all over again. I would feel real badly about that, and I would have to get over feeling bad about it and start anew with some new kind of program.
Why do you think the myths about mental illness persist? And we do know more about the causes of mental illness, and I think we are less blaming of families and mothers and mm-hmm. others who have been blamed in the past. But there still are fears, misconceptions that seem to survive through all the kind of new scientific evidence.
Yeah, and I think they survive because people don't have the facts about it. They really don't know. They tend to see people, they don't tend to see us as people once we become ill. They just get involved in their own fears regarding us. I think fear is probably the biggest culprit, the biggest hindrance to change. If people were not afraid, they would certainly react differently to us, and they would spread and cause something to spread that would be different than what we're getting now. I think fear is a real problem for us and one of the main causes of us being misunderstood.
What do you think people are afraid of?
Well, I don't think they really know. I don't think what they're afraid of is clear, which makes it even worse. You know, if they were able to identify, they could resolve it a lot quicker. But I think one of the things that they find frightening is that some of us do commit violent acts at various times. But what they don't know is that we don't commit those acts at any higher rate than the normal population. But every time they hear that a mentally ill person was involved in some violent act, the natural connection their mind makes is that all mentally ill people are somehow given to violence. And that's something they do, I think, by being a bit mindless about our situation at that time. If they knew that we don't do that at any higher rate than healthy people, if they knew how nice we were, if they knew how afraid of them we are, if they knew how afraid we are of them, I think they would see us and react differently to us.
Well, I thank you for your honesty with
us
today. Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Marnie.
My guest has been Lionel Aldridge. He was a defensive lineman for the Green Bay Packers in the 60s. Aldridge is a public speaker now, talking about his experiences with mental illness. Next time, film director Sidney Pollack, whose new film Havana stars Robert Redford. I'm Marty Moskowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne with Fresh Air. Coming up, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has the perfect gift for the hardcore jazz fan on your Christmas list, a new collection of Charlie Parker recordings from the 1940s made by Parker disciple Dean Benedetti. In C'est la vie, filmmaker Dionne Curies gives us a look into a painful chapter of her life, the end of her parents' marriage. Coming up, the director of Entre Nous and Peppermint Soda talks with us about her life on screen. And since most of us were kids, we've watched The Wizard of Oz on TV. Television critic David Bianculli says tonight on TV, you can learn about the man who invented the Land of Oz. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. More than 150 Americans who had been either held hostage or forced into hiding in Iraq and Kuwait arrived back in the U.S. this evening. While most had waves or smiles as they climbed down the stairs from a chartered jet, they had no public comment and were kept some distance away from waiting reporters at Andrews Air Force Base outside of Washington. U.S. officials say another plane will carry out more hostages tomorrow. Meanwhile, Iraq's cultural minister has repeated his country's assertion that Iraq will never give up one inch of Kuwaiti territory. NPR's Jackie Lydon has more.
As it has before, whenever there have been rumors in the Arab world that Iraq might give up some Kuwaiti territory, Iraq denied it. Today the rumors came from a Kuwaiti newspaper based in Dubai, which said that Iraq might pull back to the Rumullah oil field between the time Iraq's foreign minister went to Washington and Secretary of State James Baker came to Baghdad. The story was repeated in London's Guardian newspaper, and later in the day, a Jordanian senior official made the same assertion. But whatever this may or may not signify about Arab negotiations behind the scenes, Iraq has publicly denounced the very notion and said that Kuwait would remain the 19th province of Iraq forever. I'm Jackie Lydon in Amman.
In Washington, officials say that two U.S. Navy airplanes from the aircraft carrier Lexington collided today over the Gulf of Mexico. The fate of the crew members is not known. The accident occurred about 85 miles northwest of Key West. Secretary of State James Baker and Soviet Foreign Minister Shevardnadze opened high-level talks in Houston today. They also toured NASA headquarters and spoke to a shuttle astronaut in space. NPR's John Burnett reports.
The stated purpose of this two-day meeting between Baker and Shevardnadze is to finalize a treaty that's been 8 years in the making to reduce strategic bombers, submarines, and missiles by 30%. In a sense, this is their last chance. If both sides can resolve the outstanding but largely technical issues regarding treaty compliance, Presidents Bush and Gorbachev will sign the treaty at a summit in Moscow, possibly in February. But food seemed a more pressing issue than warheads this morning. Shevardnadze said the Soviet Union, which is suffering a food shortage this winter, would appreciate any assistance the United States could send, although he stopped short of a formal request. Baker responded that he expected President Bush to approve the idea. If the United States decides to send food shipments to its former enemy, it would be the first Soviet aid since World War II. In Houston, I'm John Burnett reporting.
OPEC oil ministers are arriving in Vienna for a year-end meeting, during which they're expected to delay making decisions on oil production quotas and prices until the Persian Gulf crisis is settled. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up almost 7 points to close at 2,596.78 in moderate trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. In jazz, there are two legendary sets of recordings that fans have always wanted to hear, but no one expected to turn up. The first is a set of cylinder recordings New Orleans trumpeter Buddy Bolden allegedly made before 1898. They're still missing. The other set was made by a Charlie Parker fan named Dean Benedetti, who recorded Parker solos in clubs in the late 1940s. That music's just been issued. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
One reason Dean Benedetti's recordings of Charlie Parker are legendary in jazz is that Benedetti was the perfect jazz fanatic. Using an amateur disc cutter in Los Angeles in 1947 and a primitive tape recorder in New York a year later, he'd camp out in clubs where Charlie Parker was playing. Parker's alto sax work was so fresh, Benedetti couldn't get enough of it. But he had almost no money to spend on blank discs and tape. So most of the time, he'd turn on his machine when Parker began a solo and turn it off when Bird was finished. Writers like to call these elusive recordings jazz's answer to the Holy Grail. Every fan had heard about them, but they disappeared when Benedetti moved to Italy in 1953. He died there a few years later. As it turned out, his brother had been keeping boxes of this stuff in his attic. Now, finally, 7 hours of this music is out in a boxed set from the mail-order house Mosaic Records. I'll give you their address later. Hardcore jazz fans will have to have this set, though it doesn't contain any amazing revelations. Parker's career has been so extensively documented, there isn't much these recordings could add to what we already know. Listening to them is a little like finding the Holy Grail and discovering you have some drinking cups at home just like it. Don't get me wrong, there's some excellent Charlie Parker here, and the sound quality of much of it is a lot better than I would have imagined. Every bit as amazing as the reconstructed sound in this set is the way co-producer and annotator Phil Schaap has been able to piece together so much about Benedetti's activities, from interviews with his accomplices and from close listening to the music itself. Schaap asks questions like, on March 8, 1947, did Benedetti fail to tape most of Bird's last set at the Heidi Ho Club because he was busy moving his equipment to his usual booth up front from the back of the room where he'd been sitting earlier? Schaap even speculates at length about the mysterious intermission pianist Bird introduces at the end of a set one night.
Ladies and gentlemen, for the next 30 minutes, you will be entertained by the inimitable Adrian George. Piano, let's bring him over for a round of applause. I have Adrian. I have Adrian George.
Dean Benedetti was the ultimate record collector. Legitimate labels couldn't put out Bird records fast enough for him, so he made his own. Benedetti, who was born in 1922, was a struggling saxophonist in the mid-1940s when the first bebop records came out. He immediately became obsessed with Charlie Parker's sound. His dedication was extraordinary. At the Onyx Club in New York, he drilled a hole through the stage from a crawl space below and would stick his microphone up through that. This accounts for the bass-heavy sound on those tapes. Oddly enough, there appears to have been little direct contact between Dean Benedetti and his idol. This box set includes a sample of recordings Benedetti made of his own playing. On one section, he plays along with solos on some Charlie Parker records. And there, at least, the two men enjoy a symbolic meeting on common ground.
Thank you.
this Christmas, if you're shopping for the jazz fan who has everything and can afford to ante up about $100, the complete Dean Benedetti recordings of Charlie Parker is the present to get. So here's the address of Mosaic Records. 35 Melrose Place, Stamford, Connecticut, 06902. Get them this box so you can sit back and gloat when they say, "How could you possibly know I wanted this?"
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. He reviewed the complete Benedetti recordings of Charlie Parker on the Mosaic label. This is Fresh Air. French filmmaker Dionne Curies makes personal films. Her 1977 film, Peppermint Soda, was about the trials of early adolescence. Entre Nous explored the bonds of female friendship and was taken from her mother's own story. Curies' new film, C'est la vie, is loosely based on events that took place on a summer holiday when her parents' marriage fell apart. Curies was a young girl when the breakup intruded on her carefree summer days.
I found out that the background, what was exciting to me, was to make a very happy background, the summer holiday, the beach and the you know, swimming and the waves and everything was nice, while a drama is going on behind. And I realized that that was maybe the key, you know, to the film.
Well, there is this feeling, I guess, in summer that you have this freedom, and as children especially, you have this time to really enjoy and get lost in activities. And I think you paint that picture very well. There's a lot of laughter. There's a lot of activity of children at the beach. But underscoring that is real conflict and difficulty, turmoil, that the children only just become aware of.
And hardly aware. They hear, they guess. The parents are whispering behind them, especially at the time. Parents wouldn't talk so much to their children. They hadn't read those books.
Right.
You know, and now it has changed a lot. And also, parents wouldn't break up that easily in the 50s, even in the early 60s. A divorced family was kind of rare. But still, I wanted, in the film, what I wanted to capture was exactly that, the what it is to be a child and innocent, and what it is when the innocence is sort of lost or gone already. So that's why I have six children in the film who go from 6 to 14 years old, and they're cousins or brothers and sisters, and every one of them is going to react in a different way. And somehow I am the different child each time.
You seem to use animals in a way that underscores the feelings of the children. And there are two scenes, one where accidentally a favorite cat is run over and killed by a car, by the father driving the car, and another time when a stray dog is taken into the family, and then as they leave their summer place, the dog has to be left there and tied to a little hut, actually, and you see the children being taken away by their nanny crying for this dog. Two very painful scenes, but they seem to really underscore the feelings that the children perhaps can't quite express.
Yeah, it's also a way, I think, for me of expressing or showing the insensitivity of the grown-ups, especially the one they had at the time and they still have sometimes today. The unconsciousness, they don't realize that it's going to be a terrible, terrible pain, and then it's going to mark them forever. I mean, it certainly did for me. The story of the dog is a true story, and the story of the cat is half truth and half made up. I have an uncle whose name is Leon, was in the film, and the other day I met him, I haven't seen him in a long time, and he said, "Why did you make me kill a cat? This is really rude." This is very
He took
nasty.
It very personally then.
He did. I mean, that's obvious. And I said, come on, it's a movie, you know.
I also enjoyed in the film how you showed men and women or boys and girls together, whether it was for the children playing doctor or tickling each other, or for the grown-ups either being together, making love together, seeing them in bed together, talking together. And it seems that you're interested in how men and women as youngsters and then as oldsters relate to each other, how they touch each other.
That's the only thing which interests me in life.
Is that right?
Well, I think I share also that with a lot of people. You know, human nature, relationships, emotions, friendships, friendship, love. What is it? You know, that we are bound to go through, and where does it come from? So it's interesting to confront the childhood point of view and the grown up points of view. You know.
Well, I think it's very sensual when you see the children playing doctor together. I think everyone did that, but there is something, I won't say sexual about it, because they're too young for that, but there is something mysterious and sensual about their interaction together.
It was a key scene for me. It was one of the reasons for me to make a film like that. People didn't understand that when I was saying, I'm going to make a film with children. And, you know, you remember when we played doctor and they would look at me like if I was, is she crazy? Is she really going to do that? And yes, and I remember when I was talking to the children who played in the film, and I said, well, we're going to have a scene where you have to play a doctor. They looked at me and they understood perfectly what I was saying, you know.
Sure.
And the little girl said, I don't have to be naked, do I? I said, of course not. You know, and she said, oh, then it's all right.
Well, it's a kind of private, secret time, right?
I mean,
everyone does it, but no one wants to reveal.
Exactly. Some people do remember. Some people had tried to forget. But we all had, you know, something like that. And children certainly do. And they don't talk about it even today. But they know what you mean.
Also, laxatives. I mean, that figures into your film. And I certainly didn't grow up in Europe, but were laxatives a big part of your summer vacation or your life?
It was, yeah. We never killed the fish that we kill in the movie.
Which is, for people that haven't seen the film, the laxatives are dropped into the fish pond. And, of course, yeah, the fish pay the price.
Yeah, they turn white at the end of the movie, at the end of the season. That was a story that I made up. But it's true that the laxative problem was like this big issue. We used to drop the laxative from the window
right.
Every night, or almost every night.
But it was something that parents, I guess, if you were a good parent, you would make sure your children took their laxatives.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, these are the details that make a film. You know, I heard someone saying one day, God is in the details. And it's true. I think a film is just this sort of choice. I wouldn't say accumulation, choice in the details, the right ones. And especially if you deal with a period movie, you have to share the same emotions or memories with the people. It's interesting to share them from one continent to another. That's the most fascinating thing for me.
Do you have a special way that you work with child actors? And I would think for a director, you don't want to intrude too much because children have a kind of spontaneity that you don't want to mess with. But at the same time, it's not just playing in front of a camera. I mean, you want them to be a character and to keep that character alive through the film.
Yeah, well, I think you have to explain to them what it is at the beginning, you know, before we start the movie. And then you just have to consider them as the grown-ups, as the adults, as the actors. And they understand perfectly what it is. They're not professionals.
Right.
We don't have professional actors, young actors in France. They're really young kids who haven't done anything in the movies. But they really understand well what you want, and that they know the difference between the reality and the fiction, you know, and they love, I mean, these women in particular, I don't know, they love the camera, they love to be imitating, playing, faire semblant, pretending. It's their favorite game. So if you present it as a game as well as a job, they're great, as long as you don't insist too much, and as long as you respect their own world, you
right.
know, and so, and as long as you give them some time to relax in between takes, because of it. But the joy that they show you when they've made this, when they've accomplished the scene, and you're happy with it, you go, great, that was great. Then it's an explosion of joy. It's so great. It's so much stronger than what an actor can bring you. You know, they laugh and they jump and they go, well, let's go for a swim now. It's incredible. It's very strong.
You were an actress before directing. How did you begin acting? How did you start?
I just thought as myself as an actress since I was a child, you know, was the clown of the family, like a lot of children, and it was my goal. So I became an actress when I was, I don't know, 19 or 20. And for a few years, I acted in plays, in TV, and, you know, a few roles here and there. And I was bored and frustrated all the time.
Is that right?
Yeah, I couldn't wait for the telephone to ring, and I didn't want to be, you know, an instrument, really. I really wanted to express myself or to communicate myself, and I realized it wouldn't happen that way, so I had to start something else, and I started to write. And that's how I wrote Peppermint Soda, which was just based on my adolescence, you know, what it is to be 13 years old in the 60s. Very simple. And I made this film, which was Peppermint Soda, which was a big success in France. And it made me a director. Then I didn't have a choice anymore. I was a director.
What are you doing next? Or have you started to write your next screenplay? Or?
No, not yet. No. Until
it's, do you have some ideas?
I have ideas, yeah.
I won't ask you what they are because I know that's
not fair. No, because I haven't decided yet. So I have a few ideas in mind. And I know through now experience that at some point it's mature, it's there. And before that, it don't even start. It takes some time. But I think when I go back to France now, I'm going to sit down and start writing again.
Is that hard, though? I guess those resting periods in between movies, I guess, where you're waiting for inspiration or you're waiting for some ideas to gel, is that an impatient time?
It's hard, but when you get older, you learn patience. That's the only thing you can learn, I think. And so I know that there's a time when it's going to happen, and I'm not too much in a hurry. I mean, the pressure is there. People ask you, so
yes,
what's the next one?
Right.
But I just had a baby, you know, and it's my first child, so I took some time with him, and I feel okay.
French filmmaker Dionne Curie's, her new film is C'est la vie. This is Fresh Air. All Things Considered is coming up, and Noah Adams has joined us. Hi, Noah.
Hi, Marty. On our program, Tom Jelton reports from Warsaw on the election there of Lech Wałęsa, a big victory. He will face lots of problems as Poland's president, most of them economic. In Yugoslavia, in Serbia, the current president has won re-election. It's a communist victory there, also a victory for Serbian nationalism, presenting a difficult picture for Yugoslavia, a country that is threatening to fall apart. The issue of a peace conference on the Middle East continues to occupy the attention of the Security Council of the United Nations. And commentator John McElraith recalls with affection the mayor of Glasgow, really and truly a politician.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tonight on NBC, John Ritter portrays L. Frank Baum, the author of The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, in a TV biography called The Dreamer of Oz. Television critic David Bianculli has this review.
If you're going to tell a story about the man who wrote The Wonderful Wizard of Oz, you've got two problems right away. One is that the audience already knows the ending. No matter how many careers Frank Baum tries, no matter how many personal failures he has, you know that he's eventually going to strike gold. The other problem is that the Judy Garland movie based on the book is as popular as the book and can't really be ignored. Surprisingly, The Dreamer of Oz turns both those problems into assets. It acknowledges the movie in the very first scene, which takes place at the Hollywood premiere of The Wizard of Oz in 1939. Annette O'Toole, playing Frank Baum's widow, is at the premiere, and a reporter's questions to her launch the drama's full-length flashback. And just like in The Wizard of Oz, the first and last scenes of The Dreamer of Oz are in black and white. Everything else is in color. As for the non-surprising ending, writers Richard Matheson and David Kirshner get around that by treating Baum's life story as a kind of fairy tale, a larger-than-life love story. Most of the fun comes from learning where Baum drew his inspirations for the characters and events in his classic children's story, which for years he developed by telling to any children who would listen. One key revision in the story comes when Baum visits his terminally ill niece.
Hello, Uncle Frank.
How are you, darling?
I'm fine. Uncle Frank, will you tell me some more about the magic land and the little boy who flew there in the house?
I would love to tell you about that. Dorothy, I've got a secret I have to tell you. It really wasn't a little boy.
It wasn't?
It was a little girl. And her name was Dorothy.
Let me try and describe what happens next because it's beautiful and almost completely visual. Frank starts telling her the story of the Tin Man, and Dorothy's bedroom door slowly glides open, filling the room with light. The Tin Woodsman is standing there and walks through the doorway. But suddenly, it's not the same doorway. He's walking outside from his own cabin and into the colorful land of Oz, where he begins chopping down a tall tree. But suddenly and forcefully, it starts to rain, and the poor Tin Man is rusted to a standstill. Then the scene fades to another terrible rainstorm, only this time it's Frank Baum who's out in the open, standing still. The camera pulls back, and we see that he's standing in a graveyard, at Dorothy's grave. Movies made for television aren't usually photographed this imaginatively, or this beautifully. The Dreamer of Oz is as pleasing to the eye as The Wizard of Oz. It's also very well acted. Ritter is a perfect choice to play Baum, and Annette O'Toole takes what could have been a standard supporting role and gives what I think is the best performance she's ever given. Finally, there's one other reason I really like The Dreamer of Oz. It shows, better than most dramas about authors, how a writer writes and how he gains inspiration from everything he sees. The Dreamer of Oz is not only inspired, it's inspiring.
David Bianculli is television critic for The New York Post. Today's show was produced by Fred Landrell. Our engineers are Audrey Viblaitis, Bob Alls, Ron Barron, Joyce Lieberman, and Richard Parker. Chris Burgeon directs the show. Terry Gross is back tomorrow. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, by this and other NPR member stations, and by a grant from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs. 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with filmmaker Sidney Pollack. He made the movies Tootsie, Out of Africa, and the new film, Havana. And we meet C.J. Chenier. He carries on the musical tradition of his father, Zydeco King Clifton Chenier. That's next time on Fresh Air.